A short time ago, a movie was released called All the President's Men. For some, the movie was a culmination of reports on what occurred during the last days of the Nixon presidency. The authors of the book from which the movie got its title were two reporters on the staff of the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. All the President's Men was not the end-all as far as Watergate is concerned, and probably neither is the most recent book the reporters have completed. Their new book is called The Final Days, and it's about the human component in the episode now called Watergate. We have an interview with Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Barbara Newman will talk with them. First, Barbara asked about the methodology used in revealing information. Sources aren't cited. Footnotes aren't used. And some reviewers question Woodward and Bernstein writing about the thoughts in people's heads. Barbara asked how they defended the credibility of their data.
Woodstein, you said that you want to talk about what's in your book instead of talking about your methodology, which most reporters have been questioning you on, and the accuracy of your quotes and how you knew what was in people's heads and so on. I get the feeling that you're slightly peeved by the reception that your book has received in some quarters. Who wants to? Bob Woodward.
No, I don't think it's a question of being peeved. It's a question that people have reacted to the excerpts, and now that the book's out, people are reacting to the book and realize that it's a thoroughly balanced, accurate account of what went on in the Nixon White House in the last 15 months.
But the thing is that, as I read the book, it was quite interesting in describing dimensions of human personalities involved in a monumental episode. You got a real feeling of what they were like. Why do you think so much of the discussion has been on, did this one say that, or that one say that, or... Why do you think? Is it because that you set yourself up as a model of investigative reporters and you are expected to meet higher standards than most people, or what?
No, I think it was a reaction to the excerpts. The several weeks before the book appeared, it was excerpted in Newsweek. By their very nature, excerpts tend to allow material to be treated sensationally. News stories were written not on the book itself, but rather on the excerpts, so that you didn't get the context of the book. Since then, the book has come out, the reviews have appeared, almost every review, all of which have been overwhelmingly favorable, with one exception I can think of. The reviews stress that it's a compassionate account. It's not sensational. The kind of material that people were focusing on in the Newsweek excerpts really amounts to a very few paragraphs out of 185,000 words.
Did you ever talk to Alexander Haig?
One thing we note in the preface, or the foreword to the book, and have noted many times, that we're not going to name who our sources are. Is it anybody who reads the book realizes most of our information came from the principals, all sorts of people who worked in the White House, and was verified and cross-checked.
The thing is that, maybe this is inaccurate, but I thought I read a quote in the press where he said, you came to Europe, but he wouldn't talk to you. And an awful lot of the book has to do with his perceptions of people.
Has anybody talked to him and asked if he talked to us directly? Do you know?
I don't really know. I'm just saying something I read in the
press. It's always a question that we've told our sources that we won't say whether or not they talked to us, and we won't reveal what they said to us. There's no way a reporter can function without having that relationship of trust with their sources. And a lot of sources told us at the time that we were interviewing them that there might come a time when they would have to stand up and say, I didn't talk to you. They might have to disavow some of the things that they told us. There's been a little bit of that. I'm not going to say whether or not Haig is in that category, but we can't be put in a position of talking about what individuals
okay.
we
Let
talk
me ask
to.
You this broad question. Can we assume that everyone who you write about in terms of their feelings and their perceptions you spoke with? Or else how would you know how they felt?
Okay, let me give you a general example. Suppose we got some information. Say there's the one line. Best thing to do is use an example. The one line in the book that Fred Buzhardt thought Richard Nixon was one of the most transparent liars he had ever met. We have that from so many people that Buzhardt told that to. It was sort of like one of the common phrases in the White House, like the bottom line or the limited modified hangout route, that we know that was Buzhardt's perception. What we did, just leaving aside the question of whether Buzhardt confirmed that to us or not, that we gave everyone an opportunity to respond to information that we had in the book.
Oh, I see. But the question is, you know, that if you just accept what someone tells someone, they might be telling people something that they really don't feel, just they want to...
Well, we were very careful about the way we handled this kind of information. In each case, as anybody who reads the book can tell, the primary accounts come from the principles we describe in the book themselves. There are a very few exceptions to that. But in each case, take, for instance, the lawyers. In addition to whichever lawyers we might have talked to, we also went through the whole legal office talking to their associates. We also went to people's families. There's nothing in the book whatsoever that was not discussed among a group of people that we talked to and that we could confirm in several different places.
The interesting journalistic question there of how do you know when somebody tells you they were feeling something or they think the following way that they're telling you the truth. Normally in journalism, if the White House press secretary comes out and says the president thinks he might veto a certain bill, it will be on every front page newspaper.
Regardless of whether that's whether
I wouldn't report that. I would say the president's press secretary said.
Sure, exactly.
You're a better reporter than most.
But it will be, normally the stories will come out, the White House said today or the White House feels it's treated like a personality. What we did in this case, if we got information from somebody saying they thought the following or their general view was, or as they went into a meeting they were thinking, unless we could verify it from two or three people who they told that to right at the time, we didn't put it in the book. And in working a full year on this book, having two full-time assistants, two really great reporters, a former Watergate investigator named Scott Armstrong, Watergate committee, and a researcher named Al Kamen. We cross-checked everything. There's all sorts of stuff we didn't put in this book because it didn't meet that standard. And if you look at it in terms of what journalism normally is, we exceeded that standard.
All right. Let's talk about some of the vignettes. Did you end up in your book with feelings at all of that you were kind of sorry for Richard Nixon?
I think certainly that it would be impossible in working on this story for 3 years and then working on this book for another year not to have compassion for Richard Nixon. That's not to say that we didn't encounter some terrible things that happened under his presidency, some of his own acts which rather astonished us. But the book is very much about a human situation, about a man under extraordinary pressure. Something is happening to him during the period we described that's never happened to another president of the United States. Nixon is a man who spent his life in pursuit of the presidency, and he was losing it. So it's very much about the human reactions, not only of Nixon, but of his family, how his aides are dealing with the realization that the president indeed is involved in the cover-up.
Let me just say that I got a feeling of real emptiness in reading your book, because so many people, with the exception of Fred Brizard, seem to be so self-serving and protecting themselves. Even Alexander Haig, I just got the feeling that there was such a lack of a moral center in terms of the way he would play off Kissinger against the president. And Kissinger really turned out to be the villain of the book, at least in my perceptions.
Well, we don't have heroes and villains in this book. We describe what we could get from our reporting. Other people have had different reactions. Some people have said Bizarre comes off as a very decent man. Others have said, well, take the opening chapter of the book, where Nixon proposes to him that missing evidence be manufactured. That's rather startling, and some people have suggested that Bizarre had a legal obligation, moral obligation, to do more than he did. On the question of Haig, I mean, he's very much a very enigmatic figure. He operates on many, many subtle levels, and we show him operating. We don't point fingers. We don't say this is good. We don't say this is bad. We just sort of show that he will, for instance, in the book, he called Senator Griffin, who was the minority whip in the Senate, and gave him information about the last tape that was coming out before it was released.
The smoking gun.
The smoking gun, June 23rd, 1972 tapes that came out the week Nixon resigned. And Haig called Griffin, and then Griffin recommended within 3 days that the president resign. When Nixon had a very negative reaction to Senator Griffin's suggestion, Haig did not disclose
that he was the source of Griffin's information.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you see a certain duplicity in Haig, as you do lots of other characters. But people have reacted very differently to it. And frankly, that's what tells us that we did a good reporting job.
It's like a Rorschach test in a way. You know, maybe you tell more about yourself the way you read the book than you do.
Well, your point about a moral center, it seems to me, is a very good one. Because in a way, the book is a morality play. It's about a 15-month period. And at the beginning of that period, Haldeman and Ehrlichman resign. A new team of advisors comes aboard. Buzhardt comes on the legal staff. Haig becomes White House Chief of Staff. And almost immediately, these people are confronted with evidence that the president is involved in the cover-up. And so we ask ourselves very often, what would we do in a similar situation? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. One of the characters in the book, Len Garment, talks some in there about the rules of presidential service. That somehow they're a little different than the rules on the outside. It's a terribly, terribly, agonizing situation for everybody involved. There aren't any easy answers, and we don't suggest them.
What about this Kissinger portrait you presented?
Well, I think it's the first time that a book has seriously tried to deal with Kissinger in the way he was day-to-day, in the way he conducted his relationships. Most writing about Kissinger has been done from either an academic plane or far removed from how he conducted his daily business.
Can you give a vignette of him?
Well, what we show in the book is the true nature, again, of so much of this book, so much of reporting really is penetrating the public facade, and the reporting on Kissinger is largely been what Kissinger has wanted reported. And we do this, and we show the nature or a hidden component in the Nixon-Kissinger relationship. And it was one in which Kissinger had a lot of loathing and contempt for Nixon. He respected some of his intellect, his ability, as he terms it, to take large bites of the problem. But there was lots of backbiting. There was lots of negative comment. There was
the meatball
feeling that,
president, he called.
That Nixon, I called him a meatball sometimes. I think of more significance, he said that Nixon cannot understand some of these complicated National Security Council papers that are being prepared, and that things have to be reduced to sort of a Reader's Digest level. And he often criticized Nixon's intellect, as he did many other people's intellect. At the same time, we show that Kissinger, no doubt, is one of the most brilliant men to ever serve in government in the United States.
How do you show that? I didn't get that.
Oh.
Well, I think the book does get into a little bit his view of what foreign policy should be, which is a very complicated view of foreign policy, that foreign policy has to exist on many levels, that it involves a manipulation of domestic politics, interestingly, a kind of similar view that Nixon had. What I find is that the really big secret of the Kissinger foreign policy apparatus was not his policy itself, but rather his own view of Nixon. That the biggest secret was how, indeed, his loathing and contempt for Nixon. Although it was mitigated, as Bob says, by certain admiration for aspects of Nixon's character. The fact that Kissinger taped the president on the telephone, as well as everybody else, but he gave such special attention to taping the president's calls. And then at one point he sent a lot of his most sensitive records up to Rockefeller's estate in New York because he had some fear that Haldeman and Ehrlichman might try to get hold of this material, and Kissinger obviously wanted it saved for his own uses, whatever they might have been.
And I think it broadens out into a portrait of not only the Nixon-Kissinger relationship, but you put Haig in there, who had been Kissinger's deputy for 4 years and then became Nixon's chief of staff, and that there was a rivalry and a competition and a concern in many triangles by one member what the other two were doing or saying behind that member's back. And It's reduced to some of its human pettiness, but this again shows these people as human beings with emotions, with fears, with feelings of deep uncertainty about what's going on that they don't know about, deep uncertainties about themselves and their ability to deal with some of these problems.
Some of what you said was kind of frightening in terms of Nixon sending back memos. He was given an option paper on something, and he checked all the options. And that's not stupidity. That's more than, I can't imagine that's something more than stupidity.
Well, we don't know the circumstances, quite honestly. What you're talking about, it was a paper that had a bunch of mutually exclusive options. Nixon checked them all. And Haig, at that point, remarked, what do we do when the president screws up? We do not know the circumstances that he did that under. It's always possible that somebody sticks a piece of paper in front of somebody and they're distracted and they start checking boxes. I don't know. There obviously are cases that are described in the book where Nixon was having trouble paying attention to things.
And it shows the contrary perceptions that people had. For instance, when Kissinger was negotiating one of the Middle East settlements on the Golan Heights, he would talk about how Nixon didn't know what was going on and that he knew where all the hills were, and Kissinger alone was really doing this. He was the brains and the force behind it. And then you shift to a scene of Nixon telling his family that, well, Kissinger wanted to come back home and I told him to stay on the job, and that's why we got this settlement. And we often in this book, because we were able to do saturation reporting, we're able to take one event and show the varying perceptions of it by the people involved.
The book is very much about the relationships in the White House and in the Nixon administration, between the president and his family, between the president and his national security advisor, between the family and Kissinger, for instance. There's a point at which Mrs. Nixon remarks to the family that Henry takes all the credit for the good things that Nixon does.
It was really interesting. Reading your book, you get mental portraits of things you can imagine. You said that Pat Nixon had not had any personal relationship with her husband since 1960 or something like
62. This is what she confided to one of her doctors. Obviously, it was something that must have been important to her because she did confide it.
But then you get and you said that someone said Nixon has to be coached. Someone on Nixon's staff said how to kiss his wife in public. In other words, they existed in their own time frame, time space. They didn't have much interrelate to each other. You got the feeling they were all so stiff with each other.
Well, it's more than that. It's very much, the book is a portrait of Nixon's loneliness and his isolation from all sorts of people.
Everyone was?
We flash from sort of Bizarre's perception of Nixon and sort of it's not quite a psychoanalysis, but his description of what makes Nixon tick, namely that Nixon is the sort of person who decided at a very early age that he had to manufacture and fabricate emotions.
Bizarre's basis for believing this is that he had heard some very private dictabelt recordings that Nixon had made. And Bizarre's view of this was that it was a kind of therapy. Nixon talked to these dictabelts really of everyday occurrences, the trees, the birds, and out of his own real emotions, which were much more sensitive to human factors than you note in his public behavior.
You know, that's amazing because he has been such a puzzle on the public scene all the years he's been there, and whoever wrote it, one of you said that maybe this is the real Nixon that is existing on these dictabelt tapes.
Well, yes. We didn't write it or anything like that. It's reported what Bizarre told all sorts of people, and it's nailed down that this was his perception of Nixon. Then you take, say, David Eisenhower. Perception of Nixon, which we have a good deal of material in the book on. And it shows that when it came down to the smoking gun tape, that it was important for the family, as David Eisenhower perceived it, to make it clear to Nixon that they still loved him, that they were not going to make a moral judgment of him because of his involvement in the cover-up, and that as soon as they could sort of maneuver Nixon around to view this as a political defeat, the resignation, rather than a moral defeat, it would be relatively easy for Nixon to leave office.
The amazing thing is, through the book, you get the feeling that Nixon really never thought he was guilty of anything.
Certainly that was the view of those around Nixon, and he seemed to give that impression to those he was closest to, that he had, and you see it on the tapes as well, real difficulty comprehending his legal situation, even though he's a lawyer.
But it isn't legal. It's legal and going back to moral.
Well, Nixon's view very much, and he expresses it on the tapes and in the book to his aides and to his family, his view very much was that this was a political battle. That Watergate was being something conducted by the press and his political enemies, that it should be governed by the same political rules which he had always followed and which he thought the opposition party always followed. He never looked at it as far as we've been able to find out in terms of moral conduct or even in terms of being aware of the legal issues involved.
It's, you know, an amazing testament, a president of a country not to have perceptions about how people even view him, not even if it were true that he wasn't guilty, but the perception was that he was, how that erodes the fabric of a country in terms of trust.
Well, again, that's something we don't get into.
Why didn't you get into that?
Because when we started working on the Watergate story and then worked on this book, we realized that we established relationships of trust and sometimes friendship with people in the White House. And we got down to their innermost feelings, their analysis, their rationalization for certain behavior. And the closer you get to that, you realize that it's so, so difficult to point fingers and say, this person's responsible or that person's responsible. It gets to be a very tangled moral problem.
That's not to say we don't deal with the issues. What we don't do is reach these finger-pointing judgment. I think all of the issues that we're talking about are very much
it's
raised.
It's not finger-pointing to say that the President of the United States should have an inflexible view of morality, is it?
No, I think what we do is we resist any such simple conclusions as that.
You know,
that
what is morality and sometimes inflexibility can lead to a disastrous course as much as total flexibility. So we're not political scientists. And what we have done is accumulate the raw data through hundreds and hundreds of hours of sitting down with these people, going through their notes, and synthesizing it into a book of this is what happened. This is as much of the story as four people could get in a single year. Now, we don't make any pretext toward infallibility, that there may be things that we don't know about. Everything is checked out and held up in this book. And we'll let the editorial writers and the columnists, of which we are distinctly not
members. Okay, can I just ask you to play that role now? I know that you... Can I get away from the reporting and ask you some of your personal feelings? Can I do that?
Well, I think, again, that they're very complicated. You mean about Nixon?
Well,
let
me just ask you, I mean, about this, what do you think about the fact that some people persisted in supporting him and others didn't until the end? What do you think about a situation like that?
We've talked about it a lot, and we ask ourselves the question, well, what would we have done if we had been aides to the president and were confronted with these moral choices? I don't know exactly how the hell I would react. Again, it's very tempting for you and I to sit here and say, oh, I would have made the right moral choice. You know, I would have bombed out of that White House and gone on, had a press conference and said that Nixon is guilty as can be, that nobody should serve in that White House. It's not nearly that
simple. What you're saying
is
when you're fighting for survival, you don't know what you'll do.
I'm saying that unless you're in that situation, that you can't, anybody that's honest with himself, it seems to me, can't really guess at his behavior until he's in a situation.
And there was something very significant about Nixon that we describe at great length in the book, and that is that he kept, we tell it through Melvin Laird's eyes, the former Secretary of Defense, who said Nixon has a certain way of keeping it so he's the only one with all of the information. So anybody who goes into that Oval Office or the Executive Office Building or sits down to consult with Nixon, there's always that knowledge that Nixon knows more of the picture than the people giving advice. The president has immense responsibilities, all sorts of things to deal with. This new team that came in after Haldeman and Ehrlichman left in the spring of 73. Fred Buzhardt, general counsel at the Defense Department. Well, he didn't know what had gone on in the White House beforehand, or he didn't know that much. Haig didn't have the full picture. Ziegler himself got
often
much closer.
Out of things, though, despite his closeness. There's an interesting specific example that might help understand this question. Very shortly after Buzhardt came to the White House, he and Garment and Haig were involved in preparing a statement of defense as the Watergate Committee was getting ready to begin its investigation. And at the time, the issue came up of had Nixon used the CIA to thwart the FBI investigation. And they tried to prepare a statement on this. And they kept going back to the president saying, why was the CIA brought into this? Because it was clear from the information that they had that Nixon had used the CIA as a foil against an FBI investigation. Nixon kept saying, national security, national security. And Buzhardt would say, give me an example. And Nixon would say, national security, that's enough. That can be, quite frankly, a very heavy number, that perhaps the President of the United States has some information which is so sensitive that he can't even share
precisely
it with his lawyer, that it might be a matter so grave, so threatening. So what does the lawyer do? Is he to believe Nixon, or is he to think that Nixon is stonewalling? You get into a rarefied atmosphere when you start to talk about the White House, where all kinds of things can go on that you and I might not be able to imagine.
We describe at some length in the book, Leon Jaworski was the special prosecutor, the second special prosecutor, and his perception of what was going on in the White House and how the special prosecutor's office dealt with all of these disclosures and trying to get tapes. We deal with the personality of Jaworski, who is somebody who knew Lyndon Johnson, had worked for Lyndon Johnson. And there's an anecdote we don't use in the book in which Jaworski was telling some of his aides in the special prosecutor's office about the office of the presidency, and that he'd known Johnson and saw Johnson a couple of weeks before he became president. Then he went to see him in the Oval Office maybe 2 or 3 weeks later, and he said there was the biggest change. Johnson hadn't changed, but there was some mystique about it. There was something that came from seeing that man that he'd known in that chair, in that office, and there was an awe and a respect that Jaworski himself had, and he could understand how. Now, this is not to forgive. This is not to say that some of these people who did these things were right. It's simply to say that you've got to go down to the human level and say, now, what might have been the rationalizations that they fed each other?
Well, it reminds me of that piece that John Hershey wrote in the New York Times magazine, where he was so excited that he talked about, remember that, the light coming into the Oval Office, and he
this
couldn't...
This is when he interviewed Ford.
Yeah, he did. The whole magazine was
right
about it, and he couldn't even exercise his reporterial skills because he was overwhelmed by the panoply of the office. But, you know, then let's get on to the obvious next step. How do we, in stopping this from happening again, we have to de-ritualize and de-sanctify the office in some way?
Well, that's what you're saying. I mean, we don't have a... an epilogue in this book in which we sit down and say, now as reporters, we think that the following laws should be changed.
Remember, I'm talking to you on a human, personal level.
It's so complicated. I mean, I don't think there's any way that I could disagree with you, that the kind of awe that the presidency is held in, for instance, results in a kind of journalism about the presidency, which reflects it, which is to say that we don't subject the presidency, perhaps, to the same kind of scrutiny that we do other institutions. And but the question is then, you know, what do you do? Do simple law? You can't pass a law that says we will hereby not hold the president in awe.
But there's another side of that, too, and many people have pointed this out, that as a result of Watergate, there's so much hysterical scrutiny of government that... You know, if a cub reporter is sent out to cover the PTA bake sale, the first reaction is to come to the bake sale
who
and
stole
say
the cookies.
Yeah, or let me see the books. Where'd that cake come from? Who's getting the proceeds from the chocolate chip cookies and so forth? And there's a, it can go.
Are we talking about, you know, the exercise of judgment, you know, and what you're saying is that people said that Watergate contributed to the disintegration of authority in the nation, and it's something Joseph Alsop still says.
Yes.
But maybe that's a good thing.
Maybe it is. But what we have got to be, or to sort of take ourselves out of this moral frame of reference as reporters. Because if we get too worked up about what the laws should be, or what people should be doing, or what things might happen, we're not going to be able to
do
our job well.
But I'm not talking to you as a reporter. I'm talking to you just on a personal level. Like, this is a living room having a conversation. You're not going to be held accountable as to three sources told you. Just what are your feelings after working?
But Carlos made the point. It's so complicated. And we get, you can look at it this way, you can look at it that way, and we really don't see ourselves as some sort of philosophers.
We don't sit in judgment. I mean, and I don't sit in judgment as an individual.
Not judging you. What are your thoughts? Are you covered it for two and a half years.
I'll give you an example of what my thoughts are. There are times in learning something that Richard Nixon had done that I would become absolutely outraged. There are other times when I would become terribly sympathetic. There's a line in that book where after Nixon and Kissinger have prayed together, right before the resignation announcement is to be made, the night before, and Nixon calls Kissinger and says to him, "Henry, don't tell anyone that I cried and that I wasn't strong." And I was so struck by the fact that obviously Kissinger had talked about it. In a funny way, I found myself thinking that was a terrible thing to do, that betrayed a kind of trust. I don't know that I would betray that sort of trust.
On the other hand, it was such an emotional,
right,
cathartic experience for Kissinger himself. You put yourself in that position. Here you are praying with the President of the United States, clearly a man who's at that moment at the end of his rope. And, I mean, can you not tell somebody or lots of people about it? I'm not sure any of us would have had the restraint
to not tell. About
reporters,
my personal feelings, anyhow, is that I'm always wary of moralists, no matter who they are, whether they're White House aides or chaplains. I find moralism much too hard to deal
with. I don't mean
to
imply moralism, so I'm putting it in the wrong framework. There is the lack of the moral center thing I brought up. I guess I mean lack of strong principles, beliefs, you know, points beyond which you don't go. And you're right. I think nobody does know till you're in the situation. It's like that thing that psychologists did on torture, how many people would press the button thinking they're giving people electric shocks. You just don't know till you're in that situation. Right. But, you know, on the other hand, here you guys, I'm just talking to you, having been involved in this, and I assume that you were pretty sophisticated, and especially, you know, I had this feeling that Carl, in a way, saw the dark side of human nature a lot. I don't know about you. How does this reinforce you?
I wear rose-colored glasses and
no, but
Bernstein
goes. I mean, how do you change it all as people?
On.
It's a good question.
It really is a good question about our personal feelings, because what I found all through reporting Watergate was that whenever I would try to make a simple judgment, whenever I would try to call on some preconception about what somebody represented to me, I always found myself as often as not being turned around. That whenever you get into a human situation, things are reduced to the most basic questions of how do you react, and that I can't put myself in a position I've never been in. It's not about being a reporter, really. It's about not judging other people unless I have a common experience
and
to
maybe
judge
that's
from.
Maybe that's the lesson, that as we've gone through this intense scrutiny of the presidency, that the people who rise to that office, the people who work for the President of the United States in the future will have this sort of Conradian secret sharer experience to have seen what happened to people who didn't ask these moral questions when decisions were made in the administration of Richard Nixon. That will be good, that will be desirable, but it's not... It seems to me that we really have a compulsion about it, and you've hit a sore point. We're almost militant about the fact of not making these sort of judgments. And the reason we're militant about it partially is that we think that it cripples us as reporters. We start sitting around, and like too many of our colleagues do, frankly, and worry about these sort of things. And we think that we want to go out and get information, check it, make sure that we're being fair, that we obtain the information ethically, and that it's relevant, and then we put it out, and then we go play tennis.
Well, also the thing is that when you topple a presidency, which basically, you didn't do it, or you hell, I'm going to back off because you're being precise about everything I say, you certainly added momentum in that direction. You don't sit around and say, and become moralist. And I'm not asking you to, but I'm saying you're young guys. You were young reporters when you got into this. Carl, you were there since you were about, 17 at the Post. You have had many years.
He was a reporter since the age of four.
Four, yeah. But how have you changed as people?
Again, I think I speak only for myself, and you have to ask Bob the same question. I think that if I've had any fundamental change as a result of this experience, it has to do with the preconceived notions and judgments about people's behavior are an impediment to really understanding what happened.
So you're less judgmental.
Exactly. For instance, reporting the Watergate story for the paper in 72, I can think of numerous occasions in which Woodward and I would come upon a particular piece of information, and I might be moved to outrage. And then in reporting on this book, learning that part of the story, which I didn't know at the time when I had expressed this outrage, seeing how much more complicated and human the actual situation was, when it was not reduced just to plain fact, devoid of any real emotion. I was just thinking, suppose you take the view, hypothetically, that Richard Nixon was this terrible man. And then you start to examine that thought, and then the more interesting question might get to be, well, if Richard Nixon was such a terrible man, how did he get to be president of the United States? How did he get to be reelected by the by this immense mandate that he had in 1972? So then it makes you raise moral questions about all of us and about the process itself. That there just aren't simple answers about that. I mean, that example of Jaworski perceiving Lyndon Johnson in a much different light when he was in the office.
Do you think that's why he didn't want to have it public that Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator because he respected the office?
Well, I think it's much more complicated than that. That was certainly an element. But the point I'm trying to make here is that indeed, there's a lot of evidence that Richard Nixon's basic politics never changed during the 25 years that we knew him or still know him in political life, that his character, there's a certain consistency of character over the years. And if you want to start raising moral questions, I think you got to raise it about all of us.
You know what I thought you brought out that was, in my mind, everyone in life who attains a lot of things gives up a lot. There's always a trade-off. I mean, most people have to do it even if you don't attain a lot. But this man, he gave up, in a way, and I say this without any value judgment, so don't jump on me, his humanity by saying that he learned at that age, he couldn't show emotion and he couldn't feel. And he poured it out on those Dictabelt tapes that you talked about.
Well, it's interesting how what you're saying is very much the same judgment Bizarre reached, that he thrust that outer shell forward when underneath he did have real emotions, but he was never able, certainly in Bizarre's view, to express them.
There are others that we treat in the book who, one of the fascinating things I found in working on this book was the information we were able to develop and put in the book on the so-called Republican establishment on the Hill. some of the key senators, members of the House, like Barry Goldwater, Hugh Scott, Senator Griffin, John Rhodes, the Republican minority leader, and to show, again, the morality play that was going on up there at the same time as they learned of one bombshell after another, the going back and forth and saying he's got to leave office, no, we've got to protect him, no, we've got to worry about our own reelection chances, we've got to worry about the party. And there's this debate, and I found it absolutely fascinating, where Senator Goldwater in the last week started thinking about it and talking to his wife and some of his friends about his feelings.
She was against having Nixon leave office, and he was for it.
No. There was just a
she didn't want him to announce his opposition to Nixon.
You mean just
continuing in office because Goldwater was up for re-election.
But what Goldwater said and talked about, and I think genuinely felt, is that he was complicitous in this, that he had helped keep Nixon in office for much longer than perhaps he should have. He let Watergate fester. He, Goldwater, did. He should have gone up there and with the authority and political influence he had, almost stormed into the Oval Office and said, look, let's get this thing cleared up. What was it? Let's have some straight answers. The people want to hear the tapes. They want to see the tapes. They don't want all this talk about executive privilege and all of these obscure principles. They want the truth. And it's, I think, in that case, I'll make a moral judgment, it's to Goldwater's credit that he could look back and reevaluate his own role.
He could be decisive anyway, make a decision one way or the other.
Well, it's interesting. It shows you how complicated the whole idea of morality is. I mean, Goldwater is a person that has been perceived, probably by ourselves included, and certainly by the media at a certain time, as suffering from a kind of moral myopia that many politicians have never been accused of. And yet in this particular instance, I'm talking about the 1964 presidential
campaign. But even that,
campaign,
everyone always thought he was personally very moral, honest. They didn't agree with what
people have had different reactions to him. But he has been, it's not so much moral myopia, I think, is that he's the ultimate Republican loyalist. If there's a Republican in trouble, Goldwater will come to his rescue, sort of. He's the perfect party person. And I think that's been a common perception of
next
him.
Next to Gerald Ford.
Yeah, that's right.
That was interesting.
But here he is. Making this harsh value judgment, we got a letter from him the other day saying that he'd gone through the table of content or the index under Goldwater and checked all of the things and how accurate everything was that we had reported in the book. And then he said, now why don't you turn your talents to figuring out why there was a Watergate burglary in the first place?
Yeah, you can't figure that. Just stupidity?
Well, nobody knows.
Howard Hughes had something there. No one knows.
Nobody has ever found out to this day exactly the reasons. I mean, I think we probably subscribe to the idea without any real evidence of it that it was a general fishing expedition, that one of the things they might have been looking for was information that Larry O'Brien had because he was a client of, because Howard Hughes was one of his clients.
I think we have quite a bit of evidence on that. You have the testimony of all of the burglars themselves, and they certainly wouldn't have sent them in there looking for something without telling them what it was they were looking for.
Also, if it were a specific piece of information, for instance, dealing with Howard Hughes, one would think that you would send in people who were fluent in English. I mean, really, at its most basic level.
I think the thing that comes out over and over is you can't underestimate the stupidity of this whole thing. And you say that you think that they would tell them, identify what to find. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they just said, find anything that looks...
Well, then they couldn't have been after it with any great passion, as some people would have suggested.
Any great passion for a single piece of information that had been designated.
I don't think they were looking for the Holy Grail in Watergate. Lots of people have said, well, there was one document involving Teddy Kennedy or one involving Howard Hughes. I think
seems unlikely. That's not the way you'd go about that kind of an operation.
In the movie, on the other book, The President's Men, there's a statement where you have Deep Throat, I think, saying that there's all kinds of things involved with the intelligence agencies, etc., and a lot of it hasn't come out yet at that point. Subsequent, a lot of it has, but do you still think there's a lot that hasn't come out?
I think you know, there are always things that you don't know about.
I mean a lot, you know, significant amounts of...
You never know. I mean, that's what's fun about being a reporter, is that you go and find out what's there. When we know something, we put it in the paper. Certainly, we were probably a little remiss about paying attention to exactly what Deep Throat said that night, which was May 17th, 1973, when he started talking about things that the CIA had done. And we even had trouble understanding what he was talking about at the time. Of course, Cy Hirsch of the New York Times seemed to have had a lot less trouble than
us. You think Cy Hirsch knows Deep Throat?
And understanding... the meaning of that, and went right to the CIA and opened up that whole area of inquiry.
How does Deep Throat feel about the toppling of the administration? Is that what he was after?
I mean, we're not going to get into that sort of discussion. We report what information our sources have,
Did you ever talk
sources
to him
feel
then?
About... I'm just not going to get into...
We do say certain things in All the President's Men that we ourselves had difficulty understanding exactly what Deep Throat's motivations were. But the one thing that we were satisfied with was that they were not related to having an axe to grind, which was to say not to particular partisan political ends.
Carl, do you know who Deep Throat is?
Yeah.
At one point, I think that it was said that you were the only one who knew Bob.
I think there are lots of people who know, It's an interesting thing. If somebody were to go do the reporting on it, I think they might be able to figure it out.
Does Deep Throat want people to figure it
out?
No,
obviously not. And we would like to identify. We'd like to identify all of our sources. What's interesting? There's such a focus on Deep Throat, where you know, in the book All the President's Men and in the movie, there's a character who's just identified as the bookkeeper.
Right.
And nobody knows who the bookkeeper is either, but nobody ever asks, who's the bookkeeper?
Could you have done this story without Deep Throat? Watergate story.
Again, it's like, it's a supposition. You don't know the answer to
Did
it.
You think
if
about
X
it?
Would have happened, would Y have happened?
Have you thought about it, though?
Sure. The answer is always the same as it is with any kind of supposition like that, that you don't know what would have happened. Certainly, Deep Throat was a tremendous help, especially in confirming information during the summer of 1972. I don't know what would have happened if we hadn't had information.
You know, I think our first book, All the President's Men, shows is that our investigation could have stopped at so many points if we couldn't have found Kent Dahlberg. If
didn't
we could
have a little luck.
If Carl hadn't gone to Florida and got the Dahlberg check. If Howard Hunt hadn't come on the phone, if we just hadn't had the experience of going around and talking to people who worked for the Committee for the Reelection of the President, who told us nothing, but we saw they were afraid.
But there wasn't luck. When you went to Florida, and then you had your researcher check out who Dahlberg was and came up, and they placed him in a state, and then you looked him up and got him, and you knew he was connected with the Republican Committee. That was not luck. That was good reporting.
It's what reporters do every day. Something happens, and they track down people. They travel. They get information.
I'll give you an example, though, of what is luck in that situation. That when I went to Florida...
Did you really do that with Cole? The receptionist wouldn't let you in, so you stood there all day, then called her, got her out of the room?
There was some fancy footwork involving in getting past that door. But on the question of the checks...
Let's just tell the audience what that was about. You wanted to confirm
what
information.
What happened was that when I got to Florida... early in the summer of 1972, I knew that there was information in the state's attorney's office down there that had to do with some checks that had gone through the accounts of the Watergate burglars. I had expected that there would be four checks there. It turned out there was five. The fifth one was a cashier's check made out to Kenneth Dahlberg, who was the Midwestern fundraising chief for the Nixon campaign. What the check did is it definitively established that there was a connection between the burglars and between the financing of Watergate and the Committee for the Reelection of the President. It turned out that the state's attorney had no idea who Kenneth Dahlberg was, and he had not intended to show me that that check. He just happened to have it in the same file. Had he taken it out like he had intended to do, I would have never known about it. That's what I mean about luck. You never know.
You mean had he not just... And also...
Had he kept it segregated from the other checks, which he had meant to do.
Yeah, it was kind
of... I wouldn't have seen it.
His ignorance not to check it out in a way, right?
Well, he was trying to find out who Dahlberg was. We're a little quicker at it than he was.
How did you get all those sources in the phone company and all that kind of stuff?
I think the same way reporters always get sources. You build a relationship of trust with people. I've been a reporter since I was 16. A lot of times when you're doing stories, it helps to have friends in the phone company. And over the years, I'd built up a number of relationships with people who worked at the phone company.
It's kind of funny, but what about you? Your interests were now, what were your interests, Bob? Were you doing investigative reporting?
My interests were in finding out who Carl's sources
were. Were you amazed by it, too?
There are probably no two people who've ever worked on a story at the beginning who are as suspicious of each other.
Really?
Yes, certainly.
You always thought the other was trying to take over?
Sure, take the whole story and run with it.
Not just that, but Woodward and I are very different people. I think we have different views of most things, certainly a lot of things. I regarded myself as very experienced at the time. I'd been in the newspaper business for a long time. Woodward had worked for the Post for 9 months. I thought he was inexperienced.
He happened to be. That's one thing we agreed on.
I didn't give him credit for how good a reporter he was.
Yeah, you seem to really have the ability, Bob, to, at least if the movie was right, of accepting criticism. And when you said that Carl rewrote the story better than you did.
One thing the movie didn't bring out is the extent to which Carl's redraft of the story was a vast improvement. I think it would have taken a very, very stubborn person to not realize that he did a much better job on that story and many other stories.
But pride, an awful lot of people...
But why be proud about something you don't do well?
Yeah, but it's quite incredible that this combination worked. Is there an awful lot of resentment with you on the Post? Because you are celebrities?
First of all, we reject that notion of being celebrities.
You might,
I don't know what it means, first of all. What is a celebrity? And
God, you're just awful.
What?
You are. There's a movie about you. You wrote two books. You're the two of the most... You're famous. You're more famous than most senators.
Hoffman and Redford are in the movie.
That's right. We were talking about this the other day. Carl doesn't agree with me fully on this, but that is the movie is out, and the... Hoffman and Redford play us, and people see the movie. That's 2 hours and 15 minutes of watching them play these roles of reporters.
Right.
They have our names. But people start identifying with their faces. And to a certain extent, that movie is and is going to more and more so return our anonymity. They're going to look for those two guys.
I change my name and become a Gentile.
Hey, listen, this is really, you're doing a psychological job on yourself because, you really are celebrities and maybe you don't want to accept it.
Some people look at us that way.
What do you mean
look at ourselves?
Perceive ourselves that way.
All right,
way.
So you're now, you're ordinary reporters. How are you going to go back and become ordinary? I guess that's what you want to do, right?
Well, people asked us that, after the first book. And we went back to work. Finished reporting the story through the resignation, picked up, kept reporting. The result is the final days, which I think we feel very good about. I think we feel it's probably the best reporting we've ever done. So I don't think we have problems being reporters. What we would have problems with is being celebrities. And I would venture to say that the minute we started to think of ourselves that way, we'd be in big trouble.
Our reaction to this, very frankly, is to become less public and become more private. Since Watergate, since Nixon resigned,
I've
really
become
both
a veritable hermit.
Both of us have been married, not to each other, but to two different women, and we live private lives.
All right, I have to close it, but I have to ask you this question. Look, you went through the most exhilarating and exhausting experience any reporter could ever have gone through. How are you going to keep up the excitement for reporting after this?
Oh, I think, the easiest thing in the world to be excited about is reporting a good story.
You mean you still got it ready to go for other stuff, huh?
Hopefully, and if we don't, then we'll go do something
Pack
else.
It up.
You going to team up again?
Oh, yeah, I don't think there's any question.
I mean, you're a team.
Right, we work together. There might be some things we work on separately, but I think we see ourselves working together.
You have a beat, what are you going to do?
We'll see what information we come up with.
You mean you'll be investigative reporting team in whatever area you want?
You have to ask Bob about this. I tend to hate the term investigative reporting.
What do you want to call it?
I think it's a shuck.
What do you want to call it?
Well, it seems to me all good reporting is the same thing. It's about finding the best obtainable version of the truth, whether you're writing about a basketball game or whether you're writing about an administration. The idea that somehow there's this pseudoscience.
It isn't pseudo, but it is more. It's opposed to saying a news conference happened today, and this is what was released.
Well, I don't consider that reporting.
But that's what most of it is, isn't it?
That's being a transducer.
Right. A transducer?
A transcriber.
No, a transducer. You uncritically take what some government or institution puts out and regurgitate it.
Isn't that what most news is?
Too much of it, yeah.
Now, what about this last question?
I want to go back and ask you a question, if I may, and that is this whole idea. I think it sort of shows the corruption of the success ethic, the idea that we wrote a couple of books, we worked on a story that was very good, so that somehow means that it incapacitates us to continue doing our job.
No, I don't mean to say that at all.
I just don't accept that at all. It starts on a premise which we reject, and that is that we didn't like our work when we started doing it. That somehow we were doing our job. Maybe it's sort of the Peter principle or something like that in reverse. The idea that people do jobs to get out of it.
But
we're not that way.
Well, I hear what I think we're saying. That there seems to be, in this country especially, this idea that in our case, for instance, that, all right, we've done some good work. So now the expectation is that we're either going to become Ross and Tom and jump off bridges and commit suicide, or we're going to do shaving cream commercials like Mark Spitz. Well, it seems to me that you can just keep on doing your work. And that's what we'd like to do.
What about the way people treat you on the Post?
See, most people, and I hate to keep following this up, but it's not that people are interested in success. It's that they're interested in failure. And what you're really sort of asking to be, I think the way I read it is, you're sort of saying, aren't you going to fail?
No.
And what we're saying is we hope we don't.
I'm not. I'm saying that in the movie.
Ask a shrink, and I'll bet you a shrink would tell you that's what that question
is. No, I'm not interested. The thing is, when Bradley defended you. Wait a minute. That's not fair. That's one of these. When Bradley
defended you. Now you're on the
interview. It's the most fun that I've ever had.
Wait a minute. We're going to finish it. When Bradley said, let those guys, or not Bradley, your editor said, let them have the story when they want to take it away from you. When you were beginning to hit pay dirt, they said they're hungry. They really want it. You, damn it, wanted success. You want it to be successful.
I think that's true. I think we want to be, we've
always... This was an interesting story, though.
Oh, I'll go beyond what you're saying, Bob. I think, obviously, when a reporter sees a good story, he wants to be good at it. And if that means success, obviously. I think anybody, whether he's a musician, a television reporter, a newspaper reporter...
Or even a radio reporter.
Right.
What do you mean even?
A ball player, whatever. You want to be successful, which means you want to be good at what you do.
So there's nothing wrong with that. Right.
I hope not. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. The two, both reporters for the Washington Post, were speaking with Barbara Newman.